We have U.S. Representative Brian Steil on the line on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will talk through several issues facing Congress, starting with the economy. The Federal Reserve said in a new policy statement yesterday that high inflation remained the result of, quote, transitory factors. Policymakers expected progress on COVID vaccines to lessen the pandemic's effect on our economy, and the Fed kept interest rates unchanged. Have you noticed higher food bills or gas prices? What do you want to convey to Capitol Hill as you live through this pandemic? It's 800-642-1234. Republican Congressperson Brian Steil represents the 1st Congressional District, including Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. Congressman Steil, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
Good morning. You've raised alarm bells on inflation, joining other Republicans to call out prices growing faster than wages. What concerns you?
So I've had an ongoing conversation with the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell. I sit on the House Financial Services Committee, which has oversight over our Federal Reserve. These have been kind of ongoing hearings that we've been doing over the past, really call it year and a half, 2 years, talking about the risk of costs of things going up. And so economists will have a debate, is the correct term inflation, but it's definitely hitting folks in the pocketbook. The question is it transitory, meaning is it temporary, or is this long-term? With the amount of spending that we're seeing coming out of Washington, D.C., I have grave concerns that what we're seeing is long-term inflation. The price of goods are definitely going up. It's more expensive if you go to fill up your car with gas. It's more expensive when you go to the grocery store. Used cars are going up. New cars are going up. Rental cars are going up. You have prices going up, and what that does is hits people in the pocketbooks of everyday people, working people, folks that are on fixed incomes, our seniors. And so we have a real challenge in front of us when Washington, D.C. is spending money in the manner that it has over the past 18 months.
But the 5.4% jump in annual inflation, that's an average of a whole lot of items, and households aren't necessarily buying the ones that are getting a lot costlier. Not everyone out there is buying new cars and used cars. Some people are spending a lot less on gas by working from home. So wouldn't there be tremendous nuance as to whether a person is really getting a pay cut in this economy?
Well, when you look at it kind of gets into detail, what is the consumer price index, which is a whole basket of goods trying to say, what is the average person really seeing and the impact of their costs? And mm-hmm. So they're seeing huge annualized increases over last year, over 2 years. Now you see some people trying to explain that your costs are going down. You saw the White House try to show that the cost of your 4th of July barbecue actually went down 16 cents. When I talk to people day in and day out across the state of Wisconsin, they're seeing costs going up. And I think that that shows up in the CPI index, which is a broad base of goods. You see it with parents who are buying get back to school goods here as we head into the month of August. Those prices are going up. And inflation functions as a tax on everyone, where everyone is seeing those costs go up. It's going to be different depending on what you personally are buying, but you're seeing costs go up across the board.
So what are you recommending that the Fed do? What would you tell Fed Chair Jerome Powell to be done to fix or stop inflation?
Well, I think there's two pieces of the puzzle. So one, you have the monetary policy where the Federal Reserve is excessively buying bonds. But on the other side, you have the fiscal issue, which is lawmakers in Washington, D.C. continue to spend money way beyond the revenues of the federal government, taking us further into deficit and further into debt. They have to sell bonds to be able to maintain this massive spending amount. That's what Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell is buying on the other end. So on one side, you have the government selling. On the other side, you have the government buying these bonds, massive amounts of money coming into the economy. And in my opinion, that's what's driving up the cost of goods for people day in and day out. I think what's essential from the lawmaker perspective in Washington is we have to get our spending under control and put us back on a path to stability.
And we're going to talk about spending and the infrastructure bill in particular in just a moment. Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with U.S. Representative Brian Steil, who represents the 1st Congressional District, includes Janesville, Racine, and Kenosha. What questions do you have for Congressman Steil? 800-642-1234. Let's zoom into your district for a moment and find out, what are you hearing locally globally about the economy and the bounce back from the pandemic and how it compares to the Great Recession, you know, when you saw the GM plant close and there was a lot of economic havoc in your district.
Now, the economy today is very different than where we were in the doldrums, right? Call it 2009, 2010, in particular in Janesville after Janesville lost the General Motors plant. But we saw manufacturing have difficult times all across the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin put in pretty significant reforms after the election of Governor Walker, making it better for businesses to come here and hire our workers. We now have a period of time where we have a shortage of workers. That's a positive thing in many ways. But at the same time, we got to make sure that we're allowing workers to get back to work. And so one of the things that we could do to address our worker shortage is to remove the $300 plus up stay-at-home bonus. And so you saw Governor Evers veto that. We've seen governors, Democrat and Republican across the country, remove that $300 stay-at-home bonus, getting workers back to work. The sooner that we come back on the other side of this pandemic and we get back to normal, we get workers back to work, students back to school, I believe the better off we are.
So what are you telling employers, though, who, you know, employees are saying, look, you're not paying enough. Wages are not keeping up with the high paying executive salaries and the actual, actual rewards these companies are seeing. That's not filtering down to your rank and file employees. What are you telling those employers to do who can't recruit at the level of pay that they're asking?
Well, the jobs that are available now across our state are higher than they were prior to the pandemic. And so you can just drive around the state. You'll see help wanted signs in places that you've never seen them before. Good paying jobs with benefits across our state. We want workers to always have a good job, a better job. But there are jobs that are available. What we want to do is make sure that we're not competing against the federal government. And so we want businesses to be competing against themselves. That's what's going to drive up wages, drive up benefits. We have some of the best workers in Wisconsin, anywhere in the country. My argument is we shouldn't have the federal government competing with the workforce in general, where we're encouraging people to stay home by paying them more to stay home than what they would be making if they were back in the market. I think there's some real opportunities to get the government out of the way and allow our workers to get back to work.
Let's bring in Megan in Dousman. Hi, Megan.
Hi, good morning. My question for Congressman Stiles, I hear him and other Republicans speaking a lot about the economy and spending and getting us back on track. And I wanted to get his thoughts on how increasing vaccination rates could contribute to that, as there would be, you know, less lost wages from being out of work and quarantine, and obviously the huge impacts of the pandemic on our economy overall. So I'm hoping to hear him advocate that his constituents and supporters get vaccinated.
Megan, thanks.
Great question, Megan. I love Dousman. I was there. They had the state frog jumping championship last weekend. I participated. My frog didn't go very far, but it is a great time when you have Dousman Derby days in Dousman. Dive into the question. I believe the vaccine is safe. I've taken the vaccine. What we have seen being the number one thing to encourage people to get the vaccine is not politicians bloviating about their opinion on the vaccine. The number one thing anyone can do, and the thing that I encourage folks who are deciding if the vaccine is right for them, is to talk to your physician. Individuals who talk to their physician walk away with the knowledge that's best for them. There's not gonna be a federal government mandate to get the vaccine. I believe it's safe, I believe it's healthy. It's shown that it can absolutely prevent people from getting seriously sick, in particular hospitalization rates amongst those who've been vaccinated. Is incredibly small compared with the general population.
But what is?
I think the vaccine is safe. I received it. But the best thing that you can do if you're making that decision is for you to go talk to your physician.
What is your stance on vaccine requirements for federal government workers like yourself and your staff?
Yeah, I don't think that we should have federal mandates on the vaccine. I do think that individuals are going to make the decision that's best for them. The number one thing individuals can do and making that decision is talking with their physician. We've seen this get politicized before the election when it was President Donald Trump. You saw now Vice President Kamala Harris play partisan politics and have questions about the vaccine. Now you see people making arguments maybe on another side. The best thing you can do is to make this non-political and to have conversations with your physician if you're undecided. I do not think that we need to have a federal government mandate to get the vaccine.
We have Congressperson Brian Stile of Wisconsin as we look at issues in Washington, repercussions for our state. Do you want Congress to continue to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol? What should be next steps? Do you live in Janesville or Kenosha, Racine? What do you want to ask your leadership in Washington? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican Congressperson Brian Stile is on the line representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. The House Select Committee investigating the deadly attack on the Capitol on January 6th. It held its first hearing this week. Four officers giving gripping testimony. Here's Sergeant Aquilino Ganel describing the scene.
I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die.
Should the committee subpoena former President Trump or get testimony from people around him that day? What do you want to ask Congressperson Brian Stile? 800-642-1234. So let's talk about the select committee. You voted against the creation of a House commission to investigate the insurrection. That commission started its work. What kind of investigation should take place on the deadly riot?
First off, what we need to do is to make sure that what occurred on January 6th never happens again. Two, we need to hold the criminals and engage in criminal behavior on January 6th accountable. You always got to allow the facts to lead us to justice. What we're seeing play out, unfortunately, is partisan politics. And that was my concern out of the gates as it relates to the investigation in the House. That doesn't mean the investigation that's also ongoing at the United States Department of Justice and the FBI. You got to remember there was a bipartisan investigation in the Senate as well. The House committee is becoming more and more partisan by the day. I was incredibly disappointed when Nancy Pelosi refused to allow two Republican members to be seated on that committee. I mean, what a missed opportunity to have the American people be able to hear both sides of any given argument, in particular where there were failures in the leadership of the Capitol Police, not the men and women that were on the front lines. Those men and women acted valiantly. But there are real questions about the Capitol Police Board, the kind of the highest levels of leadership, what the preparation was leading into that day. And I think that the fact that Nancy Pelosi removed two Republicans from that committee, refused to allow them on the committee, maybe better said, is a real show that this is going to be a more of a partisan process rather than the process that we saw in the Senate on the bipartisan investigation that the Senate did, as well as an ongoing investigation that's occurring at the United States Department of Justice and the FBI.
So what I'm hearing from you then is that this commission's work won't be fruitful, or that do you feel that there has been enough investigation then on what happened on January 6th?
The investigation may or may not be fruitful. I don't know what it will find, but I can tell you that it won't find everything. So rather than having an investigation that has Republicans and Democrats on the committee, it's a committee chosen almost now, I guess, exclusively by Nancy Pelosi. So I think it's going to miss opportunities to look at the evidence from both sides, which I think is going to be really important to making sure, one, that this never happens again. And then two, for those that engage in criminal behavior, they need to be held responsible. I just think it's a real missed opportunity where Nancy Pelosi kicked Republicans off of the committee and refused Republicans to add members to the committee.
Well, we're going to circle back here on the economy with U.S. Representative Brian Stile, represents the 1st Congressional District. Let's go to Jerry now in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. What would you like to say to the congressperson?
Well, I would first of all like to thank him very much for not discouraging people from getting the vaccine. I think that is awesome. My business was definitely hurt by the Republicans persuading people not to wear a face mask and drawing out this pandemic. Really hurt my bottom line. So I'm really glad to hear that he's not discouraging people from getting the vaccine in a 180 turnaround from what they were saying. So I really appreciate that. I would like to know what he thought about the $7.4 trillion that Trump borrowed, you know, deficit spending, versus Obama's $2.8 trillion for his last 4 years, and why there was no talk about the deficit during that period. And I just want to mention it was $4 trillion in his first 2 years when the economy was booming. He was borrowing money, giving tax cuts, zero talk about deficit spending. I want to know why he's bringing it up now.
Congressperson Style.
So what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. is spending being out of control for a very long time. So there is blame all across the board is to the vast amount of spending that's coming out of Washington, D.C. Now, you saw that continue to ramp up over a long period of time going way back. Then we got into the coronavirus. There was a period of time where excessive spending during a national emergency like that was important. I drove out from Janesville, Wisconsin, in my Chevy to Washington, D.C. at the very beginning of the COVID pandemic, where you couldn't even catch a flight, to get the CARES Act across the line. That was the act that made sure that we were making sure individuals could cover their grocery bill, their rent, or their mortgage, so people weren't losing their homes early on. That excessive spending, new government spending, although it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, was important. What we're seeing now is not just unsustainable growth in spending from what I'll call traditional or current programs, were proposals for very significant increases in the size, scale, and scope of the federal government with new government spending. So not just saying there's an increase in, say, our Army and our Navy and defense spending, or not just saying it's just increasing in social programs on the domestic discretionary side, we're seeing new programs being offered, new government spending. And so the concern is that not only were we unsustainable before, we're going to become more unsustainable if these new government programs move through. We saw a lot of that in the $1.9 trillion bill that went through earlier this year under the guise of COVID, really being excessive new government spending.
Well, I want to jump in here and see what you think of the infrastructure package that the bipartisan group over in the Senate is working on. It includes $550 billion in public works spending, roads, bridges, broadband. It will eventually make its way to you in the House. Where do you stand on this package?
So the proof is going to be in the pudding on this package. Is the final bill really going to be targeted to true infrastructure, or is this going to have a lot of new government social programs? The proof will be in the pudding when the final bill comes through. Let's say it's completely focused in on true infrastructure for sake of discussion, and that's the bill before us. The other side of the ledger, the challenge is going to be, is what is the pay for? So under the previous $1.9 trillion in new government spending, a trillion of that remains unspent. I think there's a great opportunity to repurpose those funds into hard infrastructure, roads and bridges, even, you know, potentially rural broadband, which is so critical in the state of Wisconsin. And so we're going to have to look at this bill. I've been advocating that we have targeted specific funding with ways to pay for it. And that's going to be the debate that's going to play out in Congress over probably the next 3 to 4 months.
So you really don't have an opinion on it yet as to whether you would support it or not?
Well, there's definitely not any legislative text yet. So we have bullet points as to what we're going to spend on. We don't really have substantive even bullet points as to how we're going to pay for it. And so it's easy in Washington for politicians to agree how to spend taxpayer money. It's a whole other thing for politicians to sit down and explain to taxpayers how they're going to pay for it. So I'm concerned that we're going to see rising taxes as a way to pay for it. I'm concerned about other ideas of additional debt. I think the real conversation hasn't been had yet, and that is, how will we pay for this targeted investment in infrastructure?
Really quickly here, let's bring in one more call. Dean in Black River Falls. Hi, Dean, what's on your mind?
Yes, I hear the congressman talking about competition in the workforce, which is great, you know, bring up wages and stuff. I'd like to take that one step further, and let's get more competition in our political sphere and get rid of gerrymandering so that we can have good people having a better chance of getting in office.
So, Dean, bringing up elections and gerrymandering, Congressperson, what would you say there?
I think the most important thing, we had a hearing on election law in Washington, D.C. I'm the ranking Republican on the Subcommittee on Elections and House Administration. I think what we want to see is not a government takeover of our elections. We want state control. All of the state maps is all drawn by the state assembly, state senate, and our governor. I think what you don't want is the federal government getting involved either in the process of drawing a map, but broadly speaking, in the running of our elections. Mm-hmm. I think we're best served when our states are making those decisions.
Congressman Stile, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
U.S. Representative Brian Stile represents the 1st Congressional District. Coming up, we get an update on Wisconsin's mosquito population. How bad are the bites where you live? Bring your experiences, questions, 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're discussing mosquito season on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin is home to dozens of species of mosquitoes. That is thanks to UW-Madison's entomology department for that accounting. How are mosquitoes where you are? Are they super aggressive? Not so bad? Do you wear insect repellents? What works to prevent bites? 800-642-1234. Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, and other parasites. Lyric, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good morning.
I'm glad
to be here.
Good morning. How is the mosquito population looking so far this summer?
You know, we have kind of gotten a break of some sorts from the mosquitoes this summer. We had that really weird, long, cold spring, and it seems like the mosquitoes just didn't have opportunity to ramp up in numbers like they usually do. So certainly we have some callers, I would guess, who have a different experience, but sort of as a general observation, our numbers, at least in Wisconsin, have been lower.
So that breeding season, when it was cooler, that affected the mosquito population?
You know, I don't have complete evidence of that, but that's okay. What I suspect.
Does climate change impact the population? When we see heavy rainfall that goes to drought, that goes to extreme high temperatures, what does that do?
Yeah, it's a great question and something we're trying to tackle right now in our Center of Excellence here on campus. You know, we think about mosquitoes and think, well, if it rains and there's lots of rain, then there'll be lots of mosquitoes. And that's partially true, right? Sort of like you just suggested, Kate. But a lot of rain can also wash away mosquito habitat and kill all the mosquitoes when they're in their larval stages in water. And then, right, if it's followed immediately by drought, that also can impact whether there's sufficient habitat for them to grow and develop. So it's not as simple as climate change equals more mosquitoes, but mm-hmm. climate change definitely has profound impacts on those little insects that are out in the world.
Yeah,
we have a study going on right now to see what winter temperatures do to mosquitoes. So those mosquitoes that are out there trying to survive during the winter as eggs, seems like one of the interesting things we're learning is that if they're in a tire, for example, certain kinds of mosquitoes, if they're in a tire and that tire is covered by snow, they may overwinter better. So again, climate change may lead to less snow cover and then the mosquitoes not surviving the winter as well. So it's really complex.
Yeah, and certainly complex with our warming winters, but then you have like a polar vortex and you would think that would damage the population.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that because we were just looking at information from one of our studies and shows that, yeah, even during the polar vortex where temperatures were like in the minus 30s for several weeks, there are mosquitoes in tires. And if the tires were covered by snow, the mosquitoes survived. Hmm. So pretty amazing, resilient creatures.
I view mosquitoes as these like flying bloodsuckers, but do they have more value when you look holistically at the environmental ecosystem as a whole? You know, do they have more value than how I view them?
Right. Well, first of all, it might be fun to know that like just right off the bat, half of the mosquitoes out there, if we assume that there's a 50-50 break, half of them are males. And so males never let feed. It's only the females that let feed. And there actually are types of mosquitoes that don't blood feed at all. They don't need blood in order to grow eggs. So it's really just to produce eggs. That's the reason why females, some types of female mosquitoes take blood. So maybe that alleviates some of your distress about mosquitoes, Kate. but certainly they do play some ecosystem services, probably a lot that we don't appreciate. They feed bats and ducks and birds and all kinds of things. We know from a study that was done that in places where mosquito larvae are really well controlled in the water, birds are getting less protein, and so they don't have as much to use for their own reproduction, and it can actually impact the reproductive success of birds in the area if all the mosquitoes are wiped. So it's very likely that they're really important in ways we underappreciate.
Lyric, we're having a bit of connection issues and being able to hear you here. So we're going to switch to phones as we talk with Lyric Bartholomew, who is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, other parasites. You can join in. Have you had West Nile virus or another mosquito-borne disease? What was it like? How do you protect your kids and yourself from mosquitoes? What are your best tips? Do you wear insect repellents with DEET? Have you tried repellents with natural ingredients? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in just a moment with Lyric on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mosquito season in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Your mosquito-related questions, 800-642-1234. We have Lyric Bartholomew, who directs the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease at UW-Madison, and she is with us. Lyric, perhaps broad strokes here. How does Wisconsin manage mosquitoes? Is there investment in spraying at the state level, county, city level? How does that work?
Yeah, thank you for asking. We actually had a really great vet student from UW-Madison ask that very question. And we found that by doing this broad survey of the whole state, that it's pretty patchwork. So cities like Madison have some mosquito control. Over in the Milwaukee area, there's some contracted mosquito control. But as a general rule, we don't have a state-based system for mosquito control, or what we call abatement.
Yeah, and is there like a track record of what chemicals are being put on to put the mosquitoes at bay? And wondering, is this safe for other animals and insects?
Yeah, thanks for asking that too. So when we do mosquito control in Wisconsin, we have to comply with the regulations from state agencies like the Department of Natural Resources. So there's oversight about what we use if it's done at the community level. I can't speak so much to the private companies that are brought in to do that. But a lot of what we would do in Madison, for example, would be using biological controls. So we use something called BT, which your listeners might be familiar with because it's also used in transgenic corn. So if you've heard of BT corn, there's a BT that's specific for mosquitoes. So it's a bacteria. We can put that in the water in these sort of mosquito dunks or in pellets or in soluble packets. It dissolves in the water and the mosquito larvae eat it and it destroys their guts and they die. And it's really mosquito and maybe some other fly specific. So its environmental impacts and impacts on non-target organisms are really limited. We also have then, of course, like chemical ways to control adult mosquitoes. And when those are used correctly, we use them at night. We use
We use really fine mist spray, and we just control mosquitoes that are out flying. And that way we can really minimize the impacts on pollinators and other insects. So there are really good mosquito controls when they're used correctly.
Let's bring in Alyssa in Sparta with a question. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much to the caller. I've already learned so much about a pretty interesting topic. So my question is, I have a rain barrel, and I removed the lid maybe about a month ago, and it was filled with mosquitoes. Is there something I can do to cease that activity?
Oh, thank you for asking. I also really have enjoyed using my rain barrels. It's a really great way to collect water and water your garden. And it's an important place that mosquitoes may grow and breed. So perfect that you called this morning, Alyssa. There are a couple of things you could do. You could consider putting a screen or something over the top so that mosquitoes don't have access to the water in the barrel. And if that's really impossible, sometimes based on the design, that's difficult to do. If you can't do that, you could try going to your garden store and get these mosquito dunks that are this BT that I was just talking about. So a way to kind of safely control those mosquito larvae in your backyard is with those dunks. I think you can also get them online. So those are a couple of different potential strategies, but it's great to balance those two things. Make sure you control the mosquitoes, but also do a smart job of collecting the rainwater that comes off of your roof.
Yeah, Alyssa, how long have you had the rain barrel?
Well, I've had it for about 4 years, and I move it in every winter. And this is the first year that I've noticed it.
You've noticed the mosquitoes when you opened it up?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. And in past years, that hasn't happened?
No, not to my knowledge, no.
Huh, yeah. Any thoughts there, Lyric, why maybe this year would be different?
I'm not sure. Maybe you had more time to notice, Alyssa, or it could be that this is the first thing out your backyard.
Yeah. Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for that question. You know, Lyric, we've talked before about invasive mosquito species moving into Wisconsin, the Asian rock pool mosquito, Asian tiger mosquito, too, on your radar. Are they becoming more common here?
Well, there's a mixed answer there. So the rock pool mosquito has done an extraordinary job of establishing all over the state now. We can even find it up in northern Wisconsin. So that one's done a very successful job of invading. The tiger mosquito seems to have some limits. So we're on the lookout for it. We found it in just a couple of places in Wisconsin, and we're not entirely convinced that it survives our Wisconsin winter, so might be less of a threat.
Do you think that we have reached the max of knowing how many types of mosquitoes are out there? How many species? Have you discovered them all?
Oh, I love this question. So I had this really great student working with me from the entomology department, and she did this really deep dive into the mosquitoes of Wisconsin and found that there are like 53 species of mosquitoes that we find here. So that's a fun bit of trivia. And here in the city of Madison, we also did a deep dive into the mosquitoes of the Arboretum. And in the Arboretum, we found 21 species of mosquito in all the trapping that we were doing. And then there was a 22nd. So for the first time, that same student discovered a new species of mosquito right here in Madison, right, where there's so much research ongoing all the time. So pretty exciting to think that, yeah, we certainly don't know at all in terms of what's out there.
How do you do that trapping of mosquitoes?
Yeah, so we tap into mosquito biology. You know, mosquitoes are attracted to people, and there are a couple of things that attract them to us, things like heat and carbon dioxide from our breathing. And so we have traps that actually we bait with dry ice, and dry ice releases carbon dioxide into the air that attracts mosquitoes. And we also have fitted into our traps little lights, which mm-hmm. are probably a little bit of heat, and they also just attract insects in general. You know, like a moth comes to the light at night, A lot of mosquitoes will do that too, so light is an attractant. So we use those behavioral attributes of the mosquito to coax them into us, and we trap them all in a net and then bring them back to the lab in the vet school or in the entomology department, and we can sort through and see what's there.
How much stock do you put in those citronella candles? Do they work?
Yeah, none at all, really. They smell really nice. And maybe to some extent, having just like a little bit of flame there and a little smoke coming off of the flame is helpful. But, you know, I think if you put out citronella, you'll have a nice scent out there. do a whole lot in terms of reducing the bite burden on you.
So we have a caller who called in yesterday about her dog. What can you do to keep mosquitoes away from your pets?
That one's harder, right? We do have some really great ways to control things like ticks and fleas on pets. It's harder to control flying mosquitoes. The really important thing to protect your pets is to make sure that they're on some kind of preventative for dog heartworm parasites, so that if they do get fed on by mosquitoes, they're well protected. But generally, we don't recommend using any of those kind of repellent sprays like we use on ourselves on our dogs.
Okay. We're talking with Lyric Bartholomew, who is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, other parasites. You can join in with your questions about mosquitoes where you are, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lyric, when applying repellent, what are some good tips that you have to apply mosquito repellent?
Oh, yeah. So I would just take this opportunity to point out to our listeners that the Environmental Protection Agency has a really great resource for folks to figure out what repellent to use and when and for how long. And I think that's really been useful for me and for my family. So hopefully that would be great for other folks too. And so you can go and search for the kind of active ingredient that's in the repellent, the brand name, how long you'd have to have it on before you need to reapply, and those kinds of things. But in general, I think for my family, what we use is a DEET-based product. DEET is an excellent repellent. And then what we try to do is, after we've been outdoors having fun, come inside and wipe it off. Shower or just take a washcloth and wipe it off if it's on any parts of our skin.
Let's go to Leslie. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you finished. Let's go to Leslie now in Hortonville. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, good morning. And I apologize. I just turned on your program, so this may be redundant. But I'm very, very concerned about our pollinators. And what I've experienced, I do landscape design, and I've been traveling all over the state for a couple of decades. And I am seeing the dwindling of butterflies, honeybees, bumblebees. And I hear people, they just don't understand I don't understand. This is what I really want to know, is the private companies that are out there that I'm seeing springing up everywhere, do they have regulations that they have to follow, or how does that work? Because this is very frightening to me. Thank you. And I'll take your answer off here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Leslie.
Yeah, Leslie, thank you. I don't have a good answer to your question. I don't know what products those companies are using, and they should, as people who are out applying pesticides, have pesticide application licenses, but that doesn't, control what particular products they're using. And so for anybody who is out there and thinking about using those companies, I encourage you to ask them questions, ask what they're using, and suggest that if you're doing any spraying, that it be done in the dusk and at times when pollinators aren't out and active. But I think the other problem too is that we as homeowners have so much access to so many different pesticides. You can go to a local store and find all kinds of pesticides on the shelves. And so it's great that you that you're noticing. It's so important that we take good care of our pollinators and we're good environmental stewards. And to whatever extent we can use pesticides smartly, it's really important to do so.
Yeah, so be very careful and thoughtful. Read those labels. Ask those questions. Yeah. I want to move on to the comic book that you produced about mosquitoes. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I'm so excited about this comic book. We've just put out a comic book called Mosquitoes Suck. And it's true. Mosquitoes suck in so many ways. So they truly do suck your blood. You know, they're not biters, they're suckers, actually. And they're just such a burden, right? So they're really bothersome. Sometimes they transmit pathogens. And so can be really troublesome, as you alluded to earlier in our show, Kate. But my colleagues at Iowa State and I worked with other friends now at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and some Marvel Comics artists, and we came up with this really, really cool graphic novel about this whole concept of mosquitoes sucking.
Who is your target audience?
We're really working to try and encourage kids to see themselves as scientists. So kids are our target audience, and the goal is that all kids, all from all over, have a role to play in public health and in the safety of their families. And so we'd love kids to get more involved in knowing about mosquitoes, in being change agents in their backyards, finding those mosquitoes, for example, in the rain barrels, and finding some solution to intervene. So that's our target audience and our target concept.
I'm just curious, you know, you're a scientist. What did you learn about making comic books along that journey?
Oh my gosh, it's such a phenomenal process. And it's so fun to get to work with true artists. And we went back and forth a lot on issues like how do we represent DDT and what DDT did to the environment and how important it is in mosquito control. So we actually had lots of debate. We had lots of opportunities to talk artistically about, like, how do we represent a mosquito in a way that makes it look scary and gross, but also approachable. So all kinds of things I'd never thought about before, Kate, got wrapped into that process.
So much artistry and creativity involved in that. I would imagine it was certainly something that was perhaps a challenge to you.
A great challenge and a labor of love. But what a gift to get to work with, you know, my dear friend and great colleague, Catherine Richardson Bruno over at Iowa State, and with Bob Hall, who's a Marvel Comics artist, to get to make that thing come to life.
Lyric, so much fun to catch up with you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, as always.
Lyric Bartholomew is a UW-Madison professor, studies infectious disease agents in mosquitoes, ticks, other parasites. She's director of the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. Just ahead, we have a group of DACA recipients and applicants to discuss the experiences and their views on immigration policy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.